welcome to another edition of the Byron York Show, the No Chit Chat podcast. Now, the sound might be a little different today. I'm sorry about that. Having a little problem with the microphone, the tin can, the string. Somehow it's just not working quite right, so we're doing it another way. But since it is the No Chit Chat podcast, want to get right into it. And what we're going to talk about today is voting and the lessons of wokeism for large American corporations. We're going to talk a bit about H.R. 1, that giant Democratic voting bill. Talk about that after a while. But right now, I want to start out with the lessons we're learning from Delta Airlines. They're taking it from all sides, deservedly so, after their latest jump into politics. Specifically, the company's stand against the new Georgia voting law. And the experience of Delta, I think, could be a lesson for CEOs to ponder as they pander to political activists. So the issue blows up on Wednesday. Delta's CEO, Ed Bastian, issues a statement, and he declares that Georgia's new election law is, quote, unacceptable. He says it's unacceptable. Quote, I want the entire Delta family to know that we stand together in our commitment to protect and facilitate your precious right to vote. That's what he wrote. Quote, I need to make it crystal clear that the final bill is unacceptable and does not match Delta values. You need to watch out when they start talking about the company family. As much as you may love your job, the company is not your family. Anyway, he says the law is unacceptable, and you think, who asked him? Why is it for the CEO of Delta Airlines to declare that a new law passed by the Georgia legislature and signed by the governor of Georgia is, quote, unacceptable? Why is an airline executive, speaking for his entire company, jumping into electoral politics in Georgia or any other state? If it's an airline, shouldn't it focus on flying? Okay. Now, there was some serious blowback on Capitol Hill after Bastian releases his statement. Quoting now from a tweet from the Republican Senator Roger Wicker from Mississippi, quote, Delta Airlines CEO caves to the left with a false narrative about the new Georgia voting law, which actually expands voting opportunities. He should be ashamed of himself. Another quote, this time from Tom Cotton, Republican senator from Arkansas. This is exactly right. He's referring to the Wicker tweet. This is exactly right. CEO folded under pressure and smeared the state of Georgia with lies about Georgia's election bill. So then Marco Rubio, senator from Florida, Republican, speaks to the company directly through Twitter. Quote, Delta, dear Delta, dear Delta, you are business partners with the Communist Party of China. When can we expect your letter saying that their ongoing genocide is, quote, unacceptable and does not match Delta's values? And then on Wednesday morning, Rubio posts a video to his Twitter account. Now, this is the way politicians communicate now. He's just in a t-shirt and a baseball cap, looking at the camera, making a statement. And he says that Delta's CEO and other woke corporate leaders, quote, they're hypocrites, complete and total hypocrites. Okay, that's quite a lot. Now, there's a backstory to this, and it makes Delta and Ed Bastian, the CEO, look even worse. So last week, Delta releases a statement actually praising improvements in the Georgia voting bill on absentee voting, on weekend voting, on giving poll workers more flexibility, on several things. Now, Delta statement concedes that there are, quote, concerns remain over other provisions in the legislation, but basically it's a positive assessment. So, this prompts huge blowback on the left. A lot of Twitter hashtags boycott Delta flying around. Keith Olbermann, remember Keith Olbermann? He's still around. He doesn't have a show on MSNBC as he did, what made him famous in politics. Anyway, he tweets, "Do not fly Delta. Do not spend money with Delta. Boycott Delta. Ruin Delta." Now that is just an encapsulation of the left right now. Boycott Delta, ruin Delta. Because Delta had said some relatively positive things about a law. Now, Delta shouldn't have said anything about it. But it says something, and Keith Olbermann says, ruin Delta. Now, that comes amid growing talk of punishing Georgia for its law. And on Wednesday night, President Biden himself said he would, quote, strongly support moving the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, which is scheduled for July 13 in Atlanta, moving it from Atlanta to somewhere else to protest this law. So there's talk of punishing Georgia. Now, Biden has consistently false statements about the Georgia law, just consistently misleading and false. And Karl Rove writes about that Wednesday morning in the Wall Street Journal. Just gonna quote a bit from Rove. Basically, the line is that Biden has made three specific accusations about the law, and all of them are false. So, reading from Karl Rove, Mr. Biden has made three specific claims. First, that Republicans would, quote, end voting at 5 o'clock when working people are just getting off work, end quote. That isn't true. No state closes its polls at 5 p.m. Iowa's new law moved up closing time by an hour, but polls are still open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Georgia's election reform left the state's 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. polling hours unchanged. Okay, that's one Biden accusation, and that's one false Biden accusation. Okay. Next one, returning to Karl Rove here, quote, the president also charged, quote, there will be no absentee ballots. That's also false. Georgia made all of one significant change to absentee voting, replacing the requirement that counties verify the signatures of mail-in voters. Instead, voters will provide the number from their driver's license or free state-provided ID or photocopy of the IDs given to government employees, military members or tribal members, making it easier and quicker to verify and process mail-in ballots. Okay, that's the second Biden accusation and the second false Biden accusation. So, now, finishing up with Karl Rove, one more quote from Rove. Quote, finally, the president also criticized, quote, some states for saying you cannot bring water to people standing in line waiting to vote. Here is the fuller picture. Georgia clarified its law prohibiting electioneering within 150 feet of a polling place or 25 feet of anyone waiting in line by saying politically involved groups wooing voters with free food and drinks cannot operate that close to the polls and lines. If you're more than 150 feet from the building and 25 feet from voters in line, knock yourself out. Inside those lines, the law allows only for election officials providing self-service water from an unintended receptacle to an elector waiting in line to vote. So it's just simply false. So that is the third Biden accusation and the third false accusation. So there are all these accusations flying around. There's all this talk of boycotts, and that is enough to make a CEO tremble in fear. So Ed Bastian of Delta issued his new statement to the Delta family. Now, what happened then was the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, just cut Bastian's legs out from under him. Kemp said Delta did, in fact, engage in the legislative process. Quote, this is Kemp speaking, quote, at no point did Delta share any opposition to expanding early voting, strengthening voter ID measures, increasing the use of secure drop boxes statewide, and making it easier for local election officials to administer elections, which is exactly what this bill does, end quote. Now, Kemp apparently could not resist sticking it in just a little when he said, quote, "The last time I flew Delta, I had to present my photo ID." And so we all do. So what is the lesson from this? I mean, Delta's being battered from all sides. What is the lesson? The lesson is not that the company should be in support of the new bill. And it is not that the company should be against the new bill. It is that corporations like Delta should try to stay out of hot political controversies. It is a passenger airline. It flies people around the country and around the world. It flies Trump supporters. It flies Biden supporters. It flies everybody. Why not stick to flying and stay out of politics as much as possible? So that, I think, is the lesson. I'm not sure any of these CEOs are going to take it, but that is the lesson of this latest Delta controversy. Now, in a minute, we're going to talk about another voting issue, which is H.R. 1, which is a massive new bill from Democrats, I think totally unconstitutional, that would change the way elections work in every state in the country and would federalize elections in a way that violates the clear constitutional authority of the states to conduct elections. We're going to talk about that, actually, have a guest today with Ohio's Secretary of State Frank LaRose, who, like most everybody else who respects the constitutional order on elections, is opposed to this bill. So we're going to talk to him after a word from our sponsor. And in this case, today, our sponsor is me. Now, obviously, we want as many people as possible to listen to this podcast, and we're extremely glad that you're listening right now. And we would like to have your help in helping us grow the audience. And you can do that by telling your friends about it, and they can subscribe to the Byron York Show by searching for it on any podcast service. You can Google it or visit Ricochet.com. I'll spell that. R-I-C-O-C-H-E-T, Ricochet.com. So any of those ways, we would love for you and everyone you know to become subscribers. Of course, it's free, and we would love to have you listen. So that is the word from today's sponsor, and the sponsor is me. Okay, we're back, and now, as promised, we're going to talk about H.R. 1, the giant Democratic elections bill that has just been introduced in the Senate. And one of the voices that's speaking out against H.R. 1 is Frank LaRose, who is the Secretary of State of Ohio, where you didn't hear a whole lot about the election afterwards in terms of protests and problems. Donald Trump won by 8 points there. He wasn't complaining about it. So what we want to do now is thank you for joining the program.
Well, thank you, Byron. And yeah, Ohio's proud of the way that we run our elections. It's a bipartisan enterprise, and Ohioans trust that their voice is heard.
Well, what, in your view, is the biggest problem with H.R. 1? I mean, we hear a lot about how it's going to nationalize elections that up until now have been left to the states.
Well, the biggest problem is the fact that the federal government has no role telling states how to run elections, right? I mean, even if you wrote a bill that said all states must run their elections exactly as Ohio does, I would still oppose it because it's not the correct role for the federal government to do that. I mean, to get into the wonky stuff about what the founders intended, Hamilton wrote in Federalist 59 that only in the most extreme circumstances should the federal government intervene in the matters of elections administration. And so, you know, when our friends on the left say, well, how about the Voting Rights Act? Isn't that an example? Well, I would argue the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is a completely different scenario from what is so-called H.R. 1 or the so-called For the People Act. This bill gets into the nitty-gritty details of how states should actually run elections and micromanages things like even down to the type of adhesive used on the absentee ballot return envelopes. That's a far cry from the broad scope of something like the Voting Rights Act.
You know, I remember during the great election controversy,
The one lawsuit, Trump lawsuit, that I thought should go forward was that one in Pennsylvania, where it was about the changing of the election rules by the state Supreme Court, I believe, well after the rules should have been already set. And I thought, you know, somebody's going to have to, somebody, by that I mean the Supreme Court of the United States, is going to have to decide whether states can just a state body like the election board can just change the rules without the legislature, or whether the legislature can essentially give a state election board the power just to do anything it wants. Somebody needs to straighten this out, and it's still not straightened out, is it?
Well, it's not. It's a 50-state question, though, right? Because here's what I've told the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate here in Ohio. Remove gray area. Ambiguity is not our friend. That's where the activists file their September lawsuits. And really, that's where the real concern is. I speak to a lot of Republican and conservative leaning groups. I spoke to one last night and I told them, let's not spend our time fixating on some of these conspiracy theories about secret algorithms put into voting machines by the Argentinians or whatever else. That's some pretty far-fetched stuff. But where the real concern comes in is when an activist group files a lawsuit in the month of September, and where it really gets pernicious is when you find a secretary of state or a state board of elections that's willing to just strike a deal with the ACLU or whatever left-leaning group files the lawsuit and effectively make an end run around their state legislature. And the real problem is election laws should not be made at the courthouse. They should be made at the state house, and certainly not weeks before the election is to occur.
All right. So first thing, you've got your conspiracies all wrong. It was the Venezuelans who did this. But seriously, the serious part is when you were talking about the lawsuits and the activist groups, were you kind of describing what had taken place in the state of Georgia?
Well, I mean, that's one example. We had attempts here in Ohio. I mean, I had my name on the defendant line of five different lawsuits. But guess what? Our attorney general and I, we fought them and we won every one of them. Now, we generally would lose at the trial court level and win on appeals. But that's what it takes, because it's not that there's not a role for the judiciary, but the activism that is on display, where people that could have brought their big idea to the state legislature, but instead choose to just file a strategic lawsuit, that's the thing that we have to be on guard against.
Okay, now, understanding that your main objection here is to the nationalization of elections that should, by the Constitution, be done at a state level. Understanding that, let's do talk about some specific areas of HR 1 and of voting controversies. One of the biggest, certainly in Georgia and elsewhere, was the idea of identifying absentee ballots, which you didn't seem to have a lot of trouble with in Ohio, but they had a lot of trouble with in Georgia. What's your prescription for that?
Well, what I suggest for other states to do, and this is, I testified in front of the Pennsylvania state legislature just a couple weeks ago, because they're looking to their neighbors here to the west, and Ohio is an example. What other states should do, I humbly submit, is something like what Ohio does. It starts with the bipartisan oversight of the process. Everything in Ohio is overseen by both Republicans and Democrats. We also can process our absentee ballots the day they come in. One of the big problems that Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, other states had, was that they had vaults full of absentee ballots, and they couldn't even cut the envelopes open until election day. And that led to a real backlog, just the logistics of cutting open tens of thousands of envelopes and flattening out the ballots and proofing the identification information takes a while. So we do that in Ohio. We do signature verification. We require that both Republicans and Democrats physically check those signatures and compare them to the ones on file. That was one of the lawsuits that was filed against me, by the way. For 218 years in Ohio, we've had signature verification as one of the ways that we safeguard the process. And one of the lawsuits tried to get us to stop verifying signatures, just take people's word for it, I guess. And that's not what we're going to do here in Ohio. And so that's the way the process should work. But again, that should be passed at the state level. What's included in HR 1 that's so dangerous, it gets rid of, for example, states being able to request identification. It gets rid of the signature checking that is part of the process and has been for so long.
What was your rejection rate in your signature verification with absentee ballots?
Our rejection rate overall for absentee ballots was a record low, 0.42. We were really proud of that. Normally, it hovers around 1%, the rejection rate for whatever reason, mismatched signature, failure to put the proper identification number on there, putting it in the wrong envelope or mailing it in without the right envelope or whatever else. All of the various reasons that something can be rejected normally hovers around 1%. We were really proactive about a public information campaign. We changed the instruction sheets that come with the ballot because we want to make sure every legally cast ballot, every voice can be heard in our election. So we were proud of that 0.42 rejection rate, which was a record low for our state.
Does that mean that when it was 1%, you were rejecting too many ballots?
Well, I tell you what, that was prior to my tenure. I came into this office just a year and a half ago. And so what I can tell you is that it's avoidable. And it means that more voices can be heard. And here's the other thing, Byron. We were worried that in a year when more people were voting absentee for the first time, I mean, the fact is rookies tend to make mistakes, right? So when somebody's casting an absentee ballot for the first time, we were on guard to the fact that intuitively you would think that the error rate would go up. And so we were really proactive about combating that, even requiring our boards of elections to pick up the phone and talk to the voter, tell them, hey, you're missing your signature. You should come down to the board office and bring your identification so that we can verify you are who you say you are and get your signature on this. All just customer service kind of things that we were able to do.
Now, what about just the availability of no excuse absentee voting? The Trump people in the last election were upset, not by absentee voting, but by states which kind of showered the entire state with ballots that unrequested. The idea of a requested absentee ballot, I don't think a lot of people had trouble with, but the idea of unrequested absentee ballots just floating out there was something that bothered them. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, and thanks for making that distinction, Byron, because a lot of people kind of melded those two ideas together. And what I kept trying to remind Ohioans is that we have, for close to two decades, had no-fault absentee voting, which means anybody that requests one can vote from the comfort of home. But you got to prove your identity before you request it. You got to prove your identity again when you mail it in. We've matched the signatures, all the things we just talked about. Now, contrast that to what some states did, where they just sent an absentee ballot to everybody, whether they asked for one or not. And where states have done that for a long time, states like Oregon, states like Washington State, they have a track record of doing that. That's not such a concern. But when a state turns that on for the first time, in a state like Nevada, for example, or Colorado, where they just tried to start doing that without a track record of having done that, the real concern comes down to voter list maintenance. Because if you're not working diligently to maintain the accuracy of your voter rolls, and then you decide to send a ballot to every registered voter, you're going to invariably be sending them out to a lot of people that are deceased or moved. If you're in an apartment that has a high turnover rate, you may get, you know, a dozen ballots delivered to your mailbox because we've not been maintaining accurate voter rolls in that state. Now, in Ohio, we work really hard to maintain an accurate voter roll, but we also don't want to have that sort of universal mail-in system here. We want to have the choice. If you want to vote in person, you can do that. If you want to vote absentee, we make that available to you as well.
Now, you wrote a letter about H.R. 1 to your two senators from Ohio, Portman and Brown. And one of the issues here is keeping voter rolls and keeping them sort of up to date, fresh, not sort of encrusted with people who've died and moved and all sorts of other stuff. What would H.R. 1 do to that effort?
Well, what it would do is severely restrict our ability to carry out our state law that's been in place for a long time. And what that says in Ohio is that if you go 6 years without participating, which think about it, if there are two elections a year, a primary and a general, you've missed at least 12 elections at that point. If you go 6 years without participating and you don't respond to the multiple mailings that we send you under Ohio's law, that's considered an abandoned voter registration and is removed from the voter rolls. And so we do a lot of things to try to get people to stay current, to keep voting, to participate, to stay involved in the process. But again, our system would be strictly wiped away by the passage of H.R. 1.
Mm-hmm. And what about same-day registration?
So this is another thing where it would be strictly in conflict with our state constitution. In Ohio, our constitution says you have to be registered to vote 30 days before the election. And so H.R. 1 would run, strictly in conflict with what our state constitution says.
Mm-hmm. So what if H.R. 1 were to become law? What would you're not the attorney general of Ohio, but what would the remedy for people in Ohio be?
Well, first of all, if H.R. 1 were to become law, I think it would result in a lot of chaos. And that's perhaps the worst thing about it, is that the thing that voters deserve is predictability and regularity to their elections. And we don't want to give more cause for people to distrust the results of their election. But here's what we would do in Ohio. And again, I can't speak for the attorney general, but I can tell you that I suspect we would be of the same mind on this. We would join other states in filing a lawsuit against it, because I think that H.R. 1 is plainly unconstitutional. But I hope it doesn't get that far. I hope that we can kill it in the U.S. Senate. I think the fact that they're looking at trying to change the rules of the Senate to pass it on a strict party line vote should tell you that this is not a something that enjoys universal popularity, and we need to defeat it there in the upper chamber.
And what about ballot harvesting? I know that certainly the law that was passed in Nevada was pretty disturbing. I mean, a lot of people, I think, who were just familiar with the ideas of election just as a voter, they either vote on election day, they vote early in person, or maybe they've done an absentee ballot. The idea of somebody else, a third party who might even work for a campaign, collecting your ballot and say, okay, I'll take care of this, I'll just go vote for you, is kind of distressing.
It is distressing. And in Ohio, we forbid that. We always have. In fact, in Ohio, the only way to return an absentee ballot is to either mail it in, and that's what most Ohioans do, or you can personally take it to the Board of Elections, or you can have a family member personally take it to the Board of Elections. But you can't allow, and nor would we ever consider allowing, ballot harvesting, where, as you mentioned, a paid political operative could go door to door and collect up ballots. And where that gets really ugly, and where there have been felony prosecutions in other states in recent years, is when that same political operative starts to go through that stack of ballots they just collected, and maybe they just conveniently throw out the ones that belong to someone from the other party. That's why you should never trust a perfect stranger to deliver your ballot to the Board of Elections. And that's why we would never break the bipartisan custody that Ohio always requires. As soon as my ballot leaves my hands, it's either going in the hands of the U.S. Postal Service, or it's going into the hands of our bipartisan county Board of Elections. And again, we would never want to see ballot harvesting in the Buckeye State.
And what would happen if H.R. 1 became law, as far as that's concerned?
Well, it would require it in all 50 states. I mean, it would instantly, with the stroke of the president's pen, when the bill was signed into law, it would make ballot harvesting legal in all 50 states, which is a recipe for disaster in so many ways. And I mean, the list goes on and on. Something like turning the FEC into a partisan body for its first time, or allowing political campaigns to pay the candidate a salary with taxpayer dollars. I mean, the list goes on about all the terrible ideas that are included in this piece of legislation.
No, the harvesting thing, I remember in the 2018 elections, the House elections, Republicans got kicked in a number of districts in California, where they were leading on election night, and then some of the harvesters sort of showed up with votes. And a lot of them didn't. I think some of the Republican candidates really didn't know what had hit them. They couldn't figure it out. And then they did. And a lot of them said, well, it's the law, we're going to start doing this. And that's, I think that's an entirely rational response. I personally think that's what Republicans should have done nationally when they saw how much voting by mail was taking place in this last presidential election. It was a grave mistake for President Trump to try to put all of his eggs in one basket, that is, election day in-person voting, when Democrats had spent weeks and weeks banking votes that they would already have in the bank.
But the numbers show that, and even in Ohio here, Byron, I mean, historically, again, we have two decades of history on this. In Ohio, both Republicans and Democrats have utilized absentee voting in almost equal numbers. I mean, you can just point this out over the last 20 years. That changed this past year because the person at the top of the ticket, President Trump, was telling voters on the Republican side in particular not to trust absentee voting. I think that is a mistake. And my hope is that Republican voters come back to trusting what is a reliable way to cast your ballot here.
So in Ohio, in the presidential race this last November, Republican utilization of absentee voting went down from previous presidential elections.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and that's anecdotal. I don't have a number in front of me, mm-hmm. but we saw that across the board in all 88 mm-hmm. of our counties.
Yeah. Now, I mean, obviously, Trump still won. Ohio was not really in play that much. But still, that's just kind of amazing that any party would not do everything it could to maximize its sure. voters, to maximize the ability.
Well, I think of people like my 92-year-old grandfather, who's a lifelong Republican and was excited to vote for the Republican candidates. But at the same time, he had every risk factor for the virus. And his doctor was saying, don't you dare leave your home. Well, because his grandson serves as Secretary of State, I told him, it's OK, mail in your ballot, Grandpa. We don't want to leave you out of this. But how many people out there were there like him that were afraid to leave their home? But at the same yeah. time, they were hearing from the president, hey, don't vote absentee. It's a problem.
Just a few more things now about expanding or increasing the vote. First of all, the idea, simple idea of expanding the vote seems to me kind of weird in the sense that voter participation has been going up for a bunch of elections nationwide.
Absolutely.
Turnout has been going up. And so it's like the more turnout goes up, the more Democrats and the left claim that there's voter suppression. And I'm thinking, yeah. wow, I mean, we may
it's
suppress
laughable.
The vote till it gets all the way to 100% at this point.
Well, I've used this when I'm out talking to Republican groups in Ohio. Listen, I mean, if as the left alleges, if my goal as the Republican who serves as the Ohio Secretary of State, if my goal is to suppress the vote, I'm positively terrible at it, because in Ohio, we've had record-breaking participation and we love it. We've seen in 2016 a record-breaking year. Again, 2018 was a record-breaking gubernatorial election. 2020 was by far the all-time record-breaking year in every metric you can look at in Ohio. And by the way, Republicans did really well in Ohio. So let's put to rest this tired old notion that Republicans don't want people to participate in elections. At least in Ohio, that is not the case.
Mm-hmm. Now, one last thing that has been talked about, just for the old-fashioned idea of in-person Election Day voting, is to make Election Day a holiday. I guess a Tuesday would be a holiday.
Yeah.
And thus people would be able, you know, they wouldn't have to just try to take their lunch hour and go work if they had a lunch hour. So what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I'm open to it. We had a city in Ohio do that where they gave all their employees off. And I said, well, now we should have no trouble recruiting poll workers because we've got plenty of people off work that day. The funny thing happens, though, the funny thing about human behavior is that it's hard to predict sometimes. I've had voting rights activists tell me that when you make Election Day a holiday, and they've seen this in states where they've tried it, then people say, hey, I've got Tuesday off. I'm also going to take Monday off and make it a 4-day weekend. And then it has the inverse effect of what you wanted. Right. So, you know, I think that what is better than that, and it's kind of a gimmick, really, to try to get people to participate. And I'm all for whatever we could do to get more people to participate in our elections. But what's better is to have a period of early voting like Ohio has. If you want to vote on a holiday, if you want to vote on a weekend, Ohio gives you 30 days, nearly a whole month of early voting. You can vote on a weekend. You can vote on a Sunday. You can vote on a Tuesday evening if you want to in Ohio. I mean, you know, we've got the options for you. So there's really no good excuse in a state like Ohio and in many others. If you're not voting, you've just simply chosen not to vote. That's it.
Okay. So you can vote if you want to vote within the early voting period on a Saturday or a Sunday, you can vote, right?
We have, we're one of only, I think, 5 states in the nation that offers Sunday early voting. We have Saturday okay. early voting. We've got evening early voting. So a lot of good options.
All right. Well, last question. So you have what, 30 days of early voting?
I think it comes down to 28, actually, okay. when you consider the number of days. But yeah, it's a month of early voting.
All right. You have a month of early voting. Then you have a lot of mail-in voting. By the way, what was the division in this most recent election in Ohio? What percentage of voters voted in person on election day versus in person sometime before election day versus by mail?
So the number that voted in person on election day was about 40%. So close to 60% of the ballots were cast before the polls ever opened on election. It was 59 point something. Okay. And so that's a big number. And so of those 59% that voted absentee or early, it was about a 60-40 split. About 60% voted by mail, about 40% voted early in person. But again, it varies widely by county, and this is a cultural component to this. In some counties, a lot of people participate in-person early voting. In other counties, it's less popular. But the overall number statewide were 59% participated in early and absentee voting, and then again, 41% voted on election day in person.
Okay. Now, the last question then is about the idea of an election day. I believe that the founders envisioned that there would be a day in which everybody would vote, and that would be the election. And now we've stretched that out to a month in which someone may vote 28 days before an election, and all sorts of stuff happen that might actually influence their vote. Maybe not. Most people are already have their minds made up, but it might influence some votes. And yet we allow them to vote, 28 days before election. Mm-hmm. Is there some period of time before an election where you as the Secretary of State would be uncomfortable to have people voting? You're obviously fine with 28 days before election day.
I'll tell you that I had, well, and it can get ridiculous, right? So I had the bill that reduced early voting in Ohio from what had been 35 days. We took 1 week off and thus eliminated a period of time called Golden Week that really became known as Golden Week, that our boards of elections, both Republicans and Democrats, had told us was problematic because during that period of time, somebody could walk into a board, they could register on the spot, and the board would not have any time to verify that is a legitimate registration, but then the voter could request a ballot at the same time. And so we eliminated that Golden Week period. Listen, I think that what Ohio has in place is good. I support it. I think it's an individual choice. If you want to wait closer to election day, I think that makes sense for a lot of reasons. And one of the great things about voting absentee, and one of the reasons I've promoted it, is that it allows you to cheat on the test. I mean, think about this, even as involved as some of us are, I think we can all admit that we've gotten to the ballot sometimes and you get down there into the local races and you're trying to remember now which one is the candidate I wanted to support. When you vote absentee, you flip open your laptop. My wife and I sit there at our kitchen table and we discuss our decisions as a couple, and we cast our ballots as a very informed set of voters because, again, we can do it and take our time to do it, not have to memorize all of our choices before we go into the voting booth.
Does absentee voting like that? I mean, it's you and your wife, but what if it's you? What if it's your grandfather and someone who's knocked on the door to help him fill out his ballot? Do absentee ballots raise any secret ballot concerns with you?
Well, there's the question of then the voter taking responsibility, right? Where it does become a concern, and where the way that we've addressed this in Ohio is with our senior population, as you mentioned, particularly those who are in a memory care setting environment or whatever else, so Alzheimer's patients. And what our boards of elections do in Ohio is they come out with a bipartisan team of elections officials. They'll set up at the nursing home. And then they will have both a Republican and a Democrat there to assist people. That way, it makes sure that nobody's, trying to put their thumb on the scale or direct maybe a vulnerable voter in a certain direction. But again, it's imperfect because there are humans involved. Any process involving humans is going to have imperfections. But I think that the balance that we've achieved here in Ohio is a pretty good one.
Okay, I've asked about five last questions, but is there anything else that you wanted to say about H.R. 1 or anything like this? Well, we haven't even talked. I mentioned Georgia just quickly, the Georgia law, which has spent a lot of really bad commentary about. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention about this before we wrap this up?
I think there should be, and there is, a robust conversation going on at state capitals all over the country, and that's where it should happen. And I would submit that Ohio is a good example because we've been in the national spotlight. It's no secret that two states that had a pretty smooth election last November were Ohio and Florida, and you can imagine why. These are two states that have been in the national spotlight, sometimes uncomfortably so, for decades, and we've professionalized the way we do things. There used to be a time where the Board of Elections was the place where where you sent somebody to get a job because they didn't have anywhere else to go. That's not the case. We've got competent professionals that have continuing education credits and all kinds of requirements at our boards of elections. And so, again, we've professionalized the way we do it in Ohio. I would suggest other states follow our model. But what's dangerous, what we should all work to oppose, is this H.R. 1, this massive federal overreach that will result in, first of all, it's an unfunded mandate in many ways, will result in all kinds of chaos because states, candidly, are just not ready to turn on a dime and go from what they have been doing for decades to what Speaker Pelosi and Leader Schumer decide that they should do. We don't want to let them sort of Californify, if you will, our elections in all 50 states.
All right. Frank LaRose, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Byron. Take care.
All right. That's Frank LaRose talking about H.R. 1. He's the Secretary of State of Ohio, the 51st Secretary of State of Ohio. And we'll be talking about H.R. 1 probably a lot more in the future. But right now, thanks for joining us. And join us again soon for another edition of the Byron York Show.